Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulip. This week I'll be talking with director Paige Rogers and actress Madeline Brown, who is appearing as Antigone at the Cutting Ball Theater. Conductor Joanna Carnero talks about tonight's Berklee Symphony Concert, which includes the world premiere of a Jake Heggie work. Plus, Julian de Guzman from Newsies at the Orpheum stops by to tell his story. Also, Peter Robinson will be by with a movie review as well as a review of Newsies. Stay with us. It seems like the Bay Area has gone to the Greeks as of late in various adaptations of the story of Antigone. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke with members of the African American Shakespeare Company. They're in the midst of a run of a Extigone, a contemporary adaptation set in a black urban setting. Last Friday, we broadcast here on KALW. Antigone is part of our L.A. Theater Works series. Well, Cutting Ball Theater continues its 16th season with a new translation of Antigone through March 22nd. It's directed by Paige Rogers, who joins me in studio to talk about the production. Paige co-founded Cutting Ball Theater with husband Rob Melrose, who's been a guest on a few occasions here on Open Air. Nice to have the other half on.
Thank you.
Paige is also an actress, director, and associate artistic director of Cutting Ball Theater. She's been seen locally with the Berklee Opera, Lamplighters, Sonoma County Rep, and on tour with California Shakespeare Theater, in addition to being seen at the Kennedy Center and Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Welcome to you, Paige.
Thank you.
She's joined by Madeline H.D. Brown, who returns to the company in the title role of Antigone, which she originated as part of Cutting Ball's Hidden Classics reading series in 2013. Additional credits include productions at the Aurora Theater Company, San Francisco Playhouse, Shotgun Players, and the Noir City Film Festival, among others. Madeline, welcome to you.
Hello.
You do look familiar. Well, the character Antigone is quite a piece of work. I think we need a little bit of Greek mythology 101 for an introduction, the spawn of an incestuous relationship between Oedipus and his mother Jocasta. I guess we could call that a complex relationship, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely.
Paige, maybe reprise for us, if you would, the basic outline of the Sophocles story.
Okay, and I'm going to do this in tandem with Madeline, because sometimes I find that Madeline's better prepared than I am on these kind of things. So Jocasta is from the house of Laius, or her husband is from the house of Laius, and he's a king. And they have several children together, and it's said, the oracle says, that one of their children is going to kill his father and then marry his mother and have children with her. And, of course, they don't believe that. But when they have Oedipus, they don't kill him, but they get him out of far from where they live. And, of course, the oracle comes to be true, that he overthrows his father, kills him actually on the road, and then meets his mother and marries her and has four children with his mother. And the four children are Eteocles, Polynices, Antigone, and Ismene. And those four siblings are raised by people who are actually mother and son. And at the beginning of Antigone, and this is something that means a lot to me, the two brothers, Eteocles and Polynices, have just killed one another in a war. And that leaves only Antigone and Ismene left from the whole line, because when it's... Okay, so David, this is an interesting thing, is that when it comes out, hey, guess what, Oedipus? You did marry your mother. You did have four children with your mother. Jocasta goes immediately and hangs herself, and Oedipus pokes his eyes out at that time and blinds himself. Now, Madeline, I'll let you take it from here. Because then he takes a journey with the...
He flees. The daughters go with him because he's then outcast from the city, and he blinds himself, and his sisters are there. His daughters are there. His sisters are there. It's very complicated relationships. Anyway, at this point, he does curse the sons, and says essentially they won't live long lives with these sisters either. So he then passes the curse on, and the brothers kill each other, and then eventually Antigone is rocked up in a tomb while still alive from her uncle, and and then her love-to-be, the cousin, kills himself, as does his mom, and the evil king is left all by himself to deal with the tragedy.
And the little sister lives. This Mani lives.
She does.
It's complex true. As well as a complex.
It's a little complicated.
Yeah, right. Both. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Totally.
The aforementioned African-American Shakespeare company is staging a completely reinvented version of the story set in a contemporary urban environment. This Cutting Ball production is in a new translation. Let's talk about that for a minute. What's wrong with the other translations, or what's maybe different in the pen of Daniel Sullivan?
Well, that's a really, really good question. So when I chose this play, I actually, you mentioned my spouse earlier, I said to him, can you pretend like I'm an MFA directing student, can you give me some suggestions? And he gave me a list of plays to read, and I read them all, and Antigone really spoke to me, and then I read, I don't know, 11 or 12 translations, including Antigonic, which Shotgun Players is going to be doing in the spring, by Ann Carson. And after reading all those translations, it was very confusing to me, and I said to him, this is bothersome to me that within these translations, Antigone is almost heralded like a saint. She's perfect. She doesn't say anything wrong. In this translation, it seems like she's very passive-aggressive and really kind of bitchy, too. And I said, "What? It's frustrating. What's the truth? What's the actual Greek?" And he said, "Why don't you work on a new translation?" So that's when I approached Daniel, who had seen a production that Madeline had been in called Tant Lavald that I had done a few years back. He really, really loved that production. And he's a playwright. And so I started to work with him. He has some basic Greek, but needed to reach out to those people who are fluent in ancient Greek. Those of you I pat on the back if you say you are. But in working with the actual text, I was able to say, What is this? What does it really say? Just basically translated with no playwright spin on it. And the choruses too, what did they mean at the time and why were they there? And we were able to really, I don't want to say modernize, but I want to say, like, for example, the last chorus in Antigone, Daniel did all, he did over a year's worth of study on this. He said, the last chorus in Antigone really brings the community together. They talk about, they refer to things that make the community feel that they love one another, that they have a spiritual communion with one another. And we, instead of having that chorus, have a song in a multiple harmony song. Just because our space at Cutting Ball is small, it has 60 seats, and it's a very different experience to see Antigone and to hear the music that we're singing in a very small theater, because you're really there. You're really, it's really, in a way, like the old Greek days, that it's a community watching the show. Very small space.
Talk to us a little bit about the music then. What is it based on? Is it based on ancient, or is it more contemporary sounding?
Well, it is. Madeline and I were just talking about the polyphonic singing that the group went to Poland to study at the Grotowski Institute for 2 weeks with Teatr Czar, who, by the way, Teatr Czar is going to present Armin's Sister with San Francisco International
Theater Festival.
And they're coming in May. And they have polyphonic singing from the ancient Caucasus and the Balkan lands and Georgia, and they bring these ancient songs to life. And Teatr Czar, I admire them a lot. So we went as an ensemble and studied with members of Teatr Czar, studied singing, studied movement, and it's some of that music, not all, but some of that music, and certainly in the flavor of that music that we are doing our singing. Would you agree with that, Madeline?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How did the relationship with Teatr Czar and Poland come about?
Well, it's interesting. So I was invited to go to the Dialog Festival in Wrocław, Poland in 07. And as a guest, I'd never been to Poland. I'd never seen Eastern European theater. And it was truly incredible. And I can say that's the best theater I've ever seen in my life, that week of theater in 07. And I was able to see Teatr Czar and I literally became a groupie of theirs. And they went to LA a few months later. I went down to LA and saw every one of their performances. And the following year, they came to LA again. They went to UCLA, took classes from them. So I've been a devotee of Czar for a long time, and just wanted to direct in a way that brought some of the elements that Czar uses into the theater. And that was the goal. So I knew them, they knew me, and we had an invitation to come.
Nice. Paige Rogers directing Antigone at the Cutting Ball Theater, also joined by Madeline Brown. Madeline, were you familiar with some of the other translations or interpretations of Antigone?
That's a good question. I remember reading it when I was a sophomore in high school, but I couldn't tell you which translation it was, but I loved Antigone as a character. And I remember going backwards and reading Oedipus, Rex, and Oedipus at Colonus, and then coming back to Antigone because I just really loved the ultimate third piece. So I don't know what that translation was. And I guess the most recent translation I knew before Daniel's was the one that we did in the reading series. Mm-hmm. Which translation was that?
Was that the Holderline? I can't remember. I think it might have been the Holderline. We've battered around several. Daniel's translation is very modern.
Very modern. Mm-hmm. And he has a special gift because he's
Modern in what sense?
Well, he's seen so much of our rehearsals and he's gotten to know the ensemble over the last year and back to the reading series. He was present and knew our work from Tontlawald. So he knows how I speak. He knows how Jason, who plays Creon, speaks. He kind of knows us as people. So he was able to integrate that, I believe, into his translation from the Greek. So yeah. He gives us similar rhythms that perhaps we would speak with otherwise. I have plenty of expletives, very modern expletives, that Antigone gets to say in this piece that I don't think are probably present in any other translations.
No. And thank you for not sharing. And
sure.
Not sharing that.
Being respectful. Doing my best.
But, I mean, I don't know, Madeline, if you'd agree with this, but I feel like it's a very modern translation, and yet it's also keeps with, there's a form to it, and it's kind of formal in a way as well. It's very interesting how he's married the new and the old. It's not casual in any way. It still has that sort of heightened way of speaking, but with things like, what's a good example?
I don't know if we can give a good example. It gets pretty raunchy.
It does get raunchy, but it also, it's quite beautiful in some ways too. Like, Madeline, can you just say the little part about the little bioluminescent lights?
Oh, where I get to say, reaching faintly round corners and down halls are those last bright root heads of this generation, little bioluminescent blue creatures bobbing sprightly in some dark, deep sea. Delicate, maybe just might live a while lamplights, hopeful lights indeed.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Lovely. So is this the setting itself contemporary or is it more a traditional setting?
Oh, that's interesting.
That's a very good question.
It's very, very simple setting. For me, what brought me to the play in the beginning, and my husband teases me about those all the time, is I like plays about families. A lot of plays are about families anyway. My favorite current play, you know, modern play, is August Osage County. And the four siblings meant so much to me. And it's the play starts and those brothers are dead. And who are they? And the girls, did they know? I mean, how well do they? They're actresses, right? They're thinking, oh, well, yeah, this guy who's going to be my brother. So what we did is we cast those roles of the two dead brothers. And we have some film of the four siblings interacting. And we also have on stage two very large renderings of each brother's face. So that's all it is. It's Polynices is on one side, Eteocles is on the other side, and we have two wooden benches.
But we're not talking toga sandals production.
No, and no, not at all. Very, very modern. In fact, how would you describe Jason Wong? He plays Creon. He also is the costume designer, and he
did he call it athletic urban?
Athletic urban. Athletic urban is what he said.
I like that.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the creative team involved. Some of which have been involved for a long time now. The visit to Poland, and then the reading series that Madeline was involved in. Mm-hmm. Who else is on the creative end and the cast as well?
It's Cutting Ball favorites, stalwarts, and it's Heather Basrab on lights, Cliff Carruthers on sound. Michael Loker did the set. Heather also, this is funny, she used to be a stage manager for Joe Good a long time ago, 20 years ago. But I got her, David, to be our stage manager by saying, Heather, please, would you be the stage manager and come to Poland with us? So she's the stage manager.
There's the hook.
And the lighting designer.
If you told me that, I'd be your lighting designer.
Come with us. And we're so happy to have It's a very strong team, an incredibly strong team. Now, Cliff, it's interesting because he did the sound. But we also had some of our teachers from Poland came to be with us for 10 days at the kind of the beginning of our January time together. And they only do this live polyphonic singing. So how do you work with a sound designer who really works with his computer and manufactured sounds and folks who only Czar has no recorded sound? It's all live. So that was quite fun for them. And it was, I would say it was a little nerve-wracking for me. You know, how are we going to put those two together? But the whole thing's been just a fun journey, basically, from beginning to end, because we've been working a long time.
There are a number of special events going on associated with Antigone. The gala opening is on Saturday, February 21st. On March 1st, you're going to have to pre-show tea at 4 o'clock at the Exit Theater on Taylor. It's 277 Taylor Street is where the theater is located for Cunning Ball. And then another happy hour Fridays. You can meet and mingle with the cast from 7 to 8. Nice events around the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And every Sunday after our 5 p.m. matinee, there's a talk back and a speaker. And the speakers in Eastern Europe, they have these speakers that really don't have to do with the play itself, but have to do with political things going on at the moment. For example, one of our speakers, we have two lawyers speaking about current immigration issues. And I can't wait to hear them speak about that.
That segues nicely into my next point, in that the entire season is based on, of Cutting Ball season, the 16th season is based on the theme of injustice.
That's right. And you know, in Antigone, it was one of the first plays to ever represent the individual versus the state. And Antigone, I don't know, Madeline, you speak to this too, but I think it's pretty clear how she feels that however the state may feel, it's unjust to her brother because they won't. I mean, we forgot to say, right, that the crux of the entire play is that Creon, the new king, says to everyone, these two brothers have murdered each other. One will have all rights and a proper burial, and the other's going to just lay out on the plains and be picked apart by vultures and dogs. And that's Antigone's brother, and she just says, no, not having it.
Yeah, Antigone is the embodiment of the belief that there are rules that perhaps the gods give us, or there are moral choices, ethical choices that we agree to live by, even if they're not in rule with the law, even if they go against what the law or the government may say, there are other rules that we as individuals and as communities should live by. And in this way, is she actually directly called an anarchist in this piece?
No, but...
No, in a lot of translations, she is directly called an anarchist. And a lot of the dialogue that goes on between Creon the king and Antigone in this piece are very much about where's the fulcrum of your choice. Is it in for the entire community in line with what the law says, even if you don't agree with it or understand it? Or is the fulcrum of your choices within yourself, between you and your gods, and what you feel is necessary and right?
That's Madeline Brown. She is Antigone in the Cutting Ball's first ever production of a Greek classic through March 22nd. Information at cuttingball.com. Was also joined by Paige Rogers. Paige, thanks for sharing your insight about the play.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you both, and I wish you a spectacular run.
Thank you.
This segment was pre-recorded for broadcast today. We've since learned that Antigone has been extended for an additional 6 performances, now through the end of March. More information at cuttingball.com. Still to come on today's open air, Julian de Guzman, a cast member of the Disney Alan Menken Harvey Fierstein musical Newsies, shares his story. Peter Robinson will be here with a review of that show and of the movie The Second Best Marigold Hotel. And next, a taste of what you can hear in Zellerbach Hall this evening. That's music of Maurice Ravel from his Mother Goose Suite. Music that will be featured tonight at the Berklee Symphony's concert, continuing its 2014-15 season in Zellerbach Hall under music director Joana Carneiro. Music of Brahms, his fourth symphony, and continuing the Bay Area's Jake Heggie Love Fest. Last week I talked with Jake about his opera Dead Man Walking, which was triumphantly presented by Opera Parallel last weekend. Jake's work Camille Claudel will receive its world premiere in its orchestral form, commissioned by the Berklee Symphony. It's a work that had its premiere in 2012 for mezzo-soprano and string quartet, commissioned by the Alexander String Quartet for their 30th anniversary. Here to talk a bit about tonight's concert is Joana Carneiro, the Berklee Symphony's music director, who was kind enough to take some time to visit with me again here at KALW. Thanks for coming, Joana.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you here.
Likewise.
Well, this season's concerts, as in past seasons, have been broadly themed. We've had Enigma and Sanctuary as themes for the October and January concerts, respectively. May will bring us Homage as a theme in Mozart's Requiem, as well as choruses from John Adams' Death of Klinghoffer. And for this third concert, you have the theme Imagination.
Yes, I think it's imagination and storytelling. Obviously, with Ravel, we have that very clearly. And I think with Jake Heggie's piece as well, he's telling a story, not so strictly, of course, and not to children necessarily. He's talking about a woman that had a very, very interesting, very creative life, but also very complicated and went through very, very difficult periods in her life. And of course, Camille Claudel, a wonderful artist in her own, but definitely associated with Rodin. And
well, let's tell her story a little bit for people that don't know about
Claudel. Claudel was a wonderful sculptor, and I think she lived at a time where it was very difficult for women to pursue higher education or any kind of quite formal education after a certain level in a lot of the fields. So what she decided to do was to go into a studio, and that's she became Rodin's pupil, and they began to also live a romance. They were quite involved for many, many years. But they never lived together. It was very, very difficult for her. And she went through a lot of also mental issues, and she was
in an asylum.
In an asylum, she was eventually, you know, also diagnosed with schizophrenia. So she had a very difficult life. She became pregnant with Rodin's child and aborted the baby. And one of the movements of the piece talks about that, the child of stone, a blessing that became a stone. So she had a very, very difficult life, and she destroyed a lot of her works, about 60% of her works. So I think Jake wanted to tell her story and in a way that is expressive and tender and explores really the human side and a lot of this suffering. And he chose, you know, six or seven sculptures of hers, of her works, and some of her words, and worked them with Jean Scheer into this libretto. And so we have several images that come from the sculptures and from moments of her life that are painted into music. So it's a way of telling a story through a few portraits and a few moments of her life.
This orchestrated version of Camille Claudel is a Berklee Symphony commission.
Yes.
How was that selected?
Well, when Jake was having Moby Dick at the San Francisco Opera, I was very lucky to be here for one of the performances. And Renee Mandel, our executive director, has known Jake for many, many years. And, of course, it was a dream of mine and of Renee's to commission anything of Jake's. Mm. So we had lunch with him in San Francisco, and we really didn't have high hopes for any commission within the next decade because
he's
we know
busy,
busy Jake is.
Yeah.
But Jake was the one who came to us with this idea. Of course, we said, we can do anything of yours that you would we would love. It's the first time we're playing his music at the Berklee Symphony. And he was the one who said, I would love to orchestrate these songs and I would love for you to premiere them.
I know he expressed great enthusiasm at transforming just the string quartet into a full palette of orchestra.
Yes, the string quartet version is so beautiful and colorful and so free. And I think with the orchestral version, we do hear other colors just from the fact that we have wind instruments, brass instruments, percussion instruments, and some of the melodies and some of the counterpoint, you know, we hear in different places from the original score. But the basic outline, the basic the music remained basically the same with very few changes. But the orchestration, I think, does bring a beautiful color and I think a palette also in terms of dynamics colors that a string quartet would be more difficult to get.
Speaking of changes, did you have any input or did you just give Jake free rein to do whatever he wanted to
do
with his orchestra?
Of course, we told Jake to do whatever he wanted. We were so excited and we are so excited and honored to do his music and to have this opportunity of to perform this piece for the first time that we told Jake that he could do whatever he wanted with the piece, of course.
This was written for Joyce DiDonato and the Alexander String Quartet. Now, you'll have Grammy Award-winning mezzo Sasha Cook as soloist, who triumphed in 2013 here in San Francisco in the title role on the world premiere of Mark Adamo's The Gospel of Mary Magdalene at SF Opera. So yes. Have you worked with Sasha before?
It's my first time. I saw Sasha very briefly in London just a few months ago after a performance of another Magdalene story, Adams' The Gospel According to the Other Mary. I was conducting it at the English National Opera, and Sasha came to one of the performances, and it was the first time I met her in person. Of course, I've been a great fan of hers. And just this week, on Monday, we had the privilege to hear her sing one of the songs with Jake playing at the piano for a few of our friends of the Berklee Symphony. And it's beautiful. The way she sings, the way she is, she becomes Camille Claudel is really moving and beautiful.
Well, it helps that Jake just writes so beautifully
for
the voice. It's so natural for him.
Yes, I think Sasha would speak about it much better than I do, but she speaks about the inevitability of the way he writes for voice and the effortless feeling that she has when she sings his music. So Jake has this gift and he does work extremely hard at getting this sense of music that is inevitable, like any great composer, I think.
We'll hear an excerpt from that in just a moment. But just additionally on this concert, I mentioned that the Fourth Symphony of Brahms will be on this. This is concluding your Brahms cycle with the Berklee Symphony, right?
Yes. I'm so happy that we've managed to do the Fourth Symphonies in basically 4 or 5 years. And it feels like a cycle is ending in terms of the Brahms symphonies. And it's wonderful to hear how the sound of the orchestra comes together so quickly now that we have played together for a while. And Brahms is one of my favorite composers. And I think the Fourth Symphony, it's filled with such tenderness. The beginning, the first two movements are just this music that is cyclic, like life is cyclic and just goes on. And speaking of imagination, when you think of the last movement, which is basically a variation, we have a passacaglia, we have a theme that is varied, just 8 bars that we hear for about 10 minutes.
And something that's always on every flute audition.
Yes.
Orchestral flute audition, that's for sure.
And speaking about imagination and economy of means, this is, I think, one of the greatest examples of history of music. So it's a privilege to play this symphony.
So going through the Brahms, who's the next composer you're going to do a full survey of?
Well, I have to say, one of my other very favorite composers is Schumann. So I would love to do all the symphonies of Schumann and Mendelssohn. And we've started. We've already played one of the Mendelssohn symphonies and Schumann well. So these composers, these Germanic composers, are some of my favorites, Mendelssohn, Schumann, and Brahms. And so different. It's amazing to think that the Fourth Symphony of Brahms was written after Tristan.
Wow.
When you think it, when you think of that, it's really incredible that these two pieces existed, you know.
We opened with a brief excerpt from the Ravel Mother Goose Suite, kind of French connection here. Also a wonderful opportunity for many members of the orchestra to shine, and some instruments
flute
that you don't
as well.
Flute, piccolo, a celesta, contrabassoon. So your English horn player gets a prominent solo as well.
Yes, and in Jake Heggie's piece as well, he brings that quality to a soloistic quality to some of the string players and to a lot of the wind players.
Well, I'm bringing it back to Jake's piece, Camille Claudel. I'm tempted to draw a comparison with the marginalized role of woman artist in the 19th century France and elsewhere, and the role of woman conductor in early 20th century and probably even into the 21st century culture. I imagine you're a generation removed from that. You're comfortable on the podium, as are other women coming in, but do you still feel a little bit of the history of being a newcomer in just the form of your sex on the podium?
In my case, there are not many firsts, the first woman doing this, but still some. So it means that there's still a lot of things changing. And I am part of a generation that has benefited from the work of many, many other women. But still in my generation, I hear a lot of colleagues who are female who speak about difficulties they have in pursuing this career. So I think there's still a lot to be done, for sure. I'm one of the lucky ones, and it's very difficult to generalize, for sure. But I've always done what I love. I've always been nurtured, and I have felt that my country and all the orchestras and mentors that I have worked with have taken me, regardless of being a woman or a man. And I think that's a position of privilege, for sure.
So you're now a full year into your appointment as principal conductor of the Orquestra Sinfónica Portuguesa.
Yes.
How is that going?
It's going very well, I think. The orchestra and I are getting to know each other, even though a lot of the musicians, this is in my hometown, we went to school together, and I did work with the orchestra briefly before becoming their music director. It's a great challenge. It's an orchestra that is associated with the only opera house in Portugal. So my role is to conduct a lot of the symphonic concerts, but I also have the privilege to do opera once or twice a season. So I'm exploring that side of the orchestra as well, and of my own career. I've been doing a lot of opera in my life, but mostly 21st century opera. And so it's an opportunity for me as well to explore some of the older composers of opera. So I'm very excited about it. And next week we're performing Mahler 3, for example. Sasha would be fantastic in it, for sure.
Yeah.
So it's exciting. It's a place where we can, we have a wonderful big orchestra chorus. So the means, the artistic means are there, and the quality is very good. And it's just, we're still trying to find our way and understanding what is our long-term project artistically.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that my vision for that orchestra at the moment is to really build a strong symphonic profile, because the orchestra has been quite attached to the opera house. And I would like to continue that tradition, because it's such a powerful, wonderful opera house, but also build the symphonic profile of the orchestra.
And build a community around it. I'm sure that you've gotten some wonderful responses from the community, and you're building an audience too.
Yes, so we've been lucky that we have a loyal audience, both in our opera series and in our symphonic concerts. And we do a lot of concerts on the weekends in the afternoon, and we see younger people coming, a lot of families coming together. So that's also very promising for the future of our country and of our audience, of course.
So that must take up a lot of your time with the Orquestra Sinfónica Portuguesa. What else do you have time for? What else are you looking forward to this spring?
Well, of course, we have one more concert here with Death of Klinghoffer Choruses and Mozart's Requiem. And I'm also conducting Verdi Requiem for the first time in a few weeks at the Gothenburg Symphony.
Exciting. What a piece of music
that
is.
Oh, I think it's really one of the most beautiful, moving pieces ever written. And for someone who was not really religious, which is very interesting. So I think it's just a privilege that I'm allowed to do all this wonderful repertoire. I think think...
Maybe the Verdi will make it to the Berkeley Symphony future season, maybe?
I think so. I think it would be wonderful. Maybe not next season because we're doing Mozart's Requiem this year, but it's a piece that Renee and I have talked a great deal about, and it's something that I feel naturally in me, in my body, in my soul. So I think it's a piece that I will continue to conduct for many years if I can, I'm allowed.
That sounds exciting. Any other projects that are on the table?
Well, Rake's Progress. I'm conducting in Lisbon, so, and it will be a new production with a wonderful Portuguese director who has done Rake's Progress in Basel a few years ago, very successfully. And one of the things that I'm looking forward is to finishing now the 10 performances of A Flowering Tree by John Adams at the Gothenburg Opera. We opened about 3 weeks ago with a beautiful production by Nicola Raab that we performed in Chicago Opera Theater a few years ago. And the production is really, really amazing. There's an American tenor, Eric Fennell, in it. And so I'm looking forward to continuing it. It's fantastic, fantastic music. So lots of great music. I'm very lucky.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, let's have you back in May to talk about the next Berkeley Symphony concert of music of John Adams and Mozart, if you'll be so kind to join us again then.
I would love to. Thank you, David, for always having me and supporting our orchestra in such a beautiful way. Thank you.
Let's hear an excerpt now from Jake Heggie's Camille Claudel on tonight's Berkeley Symphony Concert in Zeller Bach Hall. In this recording, we'll hear the string quartet version played by the commissioning ensemble, the Alexander String Quartet, with Joyce DiDonato singing. It's from the final movement, an epilogue, where Camille's childhood friend from earlier school days visits her in 1929 at the Mont de Vergue Asylum, 16 years into her confinement there. Music of Jake Heggie.
For coming, I thought everyone had forgotten. I understand.
mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato singing that epilogue from Jake Heggie's Camille Claudel. In that string quartet version, commissioned by the Alexander String Quartet, who you heard there, you'll hear the full Berklee Symphony and a full orchestration by Jake Heggie performing that work tonight at Zellerbach Hall, 8 p.m., as part of the Berklee Symphony 2014-15 concert season. Imagination, the theme. Also on the program, music of Ravel and Brahms. KLW is a media sponsor of the Berklee Symphony, by the way. Information about that concert at berkleesymphony.org. By the way, we'll be broadcasting tonight's concert later on May 25th as part of a full month of Monday evening broadcasts of the entire 2014-15 Berklee Symphony season. So tune into that and check our website for updates, klw.org. From Zellerbach Hall, we jump back across the bay to the Orpheum Theater, where the Disney Alan Menken Harvey Fierstein musical Newsies is in the midst of its run through the 15th of March. My guest, Julian de Guzman, is a member of the Newsies touring cast, playing the role of Finch and dancing in this ensemble-driven show. He comes to us fresh from the Broadway production, where he was an understudy of sorts for some 14 different roles. Julian, welcome to KALW.
Hello, happy to be here.
So this Newsies is, we need to hear a little bit of background. What is a Newsie?
Well, a Newsie, I don't really answer this question very much, but a Newsie is a newsboy. Before iPhones, before iPads, before the digital era in receiving news and information, what people read were newspapers. And the way they got these newspapers...
You say newspapers?
Yeah, what is that? Right? Well, back in around the turn of the century, leading all the way up to, let's say, the 30s, 40s, 50s, when they started to be phased out, this method of selling newspapers, people got their newspapers by way of buying them from newsboys on the street. What these newsboys would do is they would buy these newspapers in 10, 20, 50, whatever amount they want from the actual newspaper itself, the distributor, for a certain amount of money. And then they sold these newspapers on the street to people, whoever wanted them, for a very, very small profit. And that's how they supported themselves and their livelihood.
And that small profit and their livelihood is the subject of this 1899 strike, which was a youth-led campaign to force change in the way that Pulitzer and Randolph Hearst newspapers compensated their child labor force.
Yeah, and it changed the course in how children and how labor laws were viewed and shaped in this country.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that this is very much an ensemble-driven role that you play in the role of Finch. Talk to us about the rigors of doing a show like this. It's such a physical show.
It's a very physical, demanding show. Being the role of Finch, I'm one of the newsboys that, you know, dreams of a better life on the street, and we have this leader, Jack Kelly, who is our sort of band leader as a newsboy, and I, along with 13 other newsboys on stage, you know, are jumping, turning, flipping, everything under the sun, any kind of trick you could imagine we're doing on that stage, and we're working up quite a sweat up there 8 times a week.
Well, that, we have to talk about your personal story a little bit, because this has to be a particular challenge for you, because not too many years ago, 3 years ago, you had some very serious health issues with your the upper part of your femur, I understand.
Well, I first started dealing with my hip issues in 2009. In college, I would be in my dance classes, and I would go to do an across-the-floor exercise, which is typical for a ballet modern class, and then I would put weight onto my left leg, and then I would just collapse to the floor. And the first few times it happened, in my mind, I thought, oh, it's whatever. My hip flexors are probably really weak or overuse or whatever. After it happened a bunch of times in the studio, one of my ballet teachers stopped me and said, you need to get an x-ray. You need to figure out what's going on. And so I finally got an x-ray, and it revealed a small lesion on the head of my left femoral head, which a doctor that's a colleague of my mother said he didn't know what it was, so he recommended I go back down to UC Irvine, where I was an undergraduate at the time, and get it looked at some more. And the biopsy revealed that it was a rare form of a bone tumor called a chondroblastoma, which occurs in 0.01 in 100,000 people.
Oh my gosh.
On that site specifically. And so the doctor was telling me, you're double major, right? What's your other major? You might want to look into that. And that was a complete shock. I didn't know what was going to happen at that point. But I ended up having a surgery, and where they basically, the science of it, they grafted bone from my hip, and then they packed it onto the tumor site. And then for a few months, I was fine. I was good and well. I was dancing again after a few months of learning how to walk again, quite literally.
Wow.
And then after about a year, they found that the tumor had actually recurred on the same spot. And I came back to San Francisco, where I came back to Alameda, where my parents' house is, and I hung out there for a little bit. Saw a doctor Dr. Richard O'Donnell at UCSF Medical Center. And I essentially had the same surgery over again, but instead had bone cement put in place, and went through the whole process of trying to learn how to walk again. Literally gave myself rehab trying to learn how to dance again. And then after about 3 or 4 months of rehabbing myself, I came up with enough confidence to be able to move to New York and bought a one-way ticket. And 2 weeks after moving to the city, I booked my first professional job as a dancer in the city.
That's such an... I mean, that is the banner headline for the newspaper. Local boy makes good, overcomes cancer, and is dancing on Broadway. That's an amazing, amazing story, Jim.
Well, I mean, it's something that I always try to remind myself if I'm ever having a rough day, because this is a very physical show. And if I'm ever having one of those days where it's just, you know, that much harder to just get off the floor while I'm stretching, you know, before a matinee on a Sunday during a 5-show weekend, it helps me get through. Thinking about that helps me get through those times.
And how do you get there? Is there special exercise you got to keep on top of to keep your physical body on top of your form?
Well, for all the ensemble members of the show, each track, as we call it, a role in the show, everybody does something different because everyone has particular strengths. And that's one of the things that our choreographer, Tony Award-winning choreographer, I might add, Chris Catelli, made sure to play up to all of our individual strengths. So everybody in the show, even though we're all on stage at the same time, we all do different things, and so our bodies require different things in the show. So for me personally, I like to do a lot of yoga stretching and heavy breathing exercises, because the physical nature of the show is one thing that's I'm not used to it, but I know how to deal with that. The thing for me is I haven't done this show 8 times a week. On Broadway, I was a swing for the show, so I wasn't on all the time performing. The hardest thing for me is the vocal aspect of the show, because it's a very, very high show to sing. Alan Menken, you know, he did some work and made sure that we were earning our paychecks and singing that score.
Just
so,
to remind people, Academy Award winning scores for The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Pocahontas, also The Hunchback of Notre Dame. This is some serious stuff.
Yeah, it's quite the beast to conquer vocally and physically with the choreography.
My gosh. Well, let's have a little taste of the New York that Alan Menken wrote. This is from Newsies and the King of New York. You, local boy made good. You're the king of Broadway here in San Francisco. Thanks for coming in today, Julian.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be here.
Have a fantastic run.
Thank you.
You don't need money when you're famous. They give you whatever you want gratis.
Such as
a pair of new shoes with matching laces.
Permanent box at the Sheep's Head Races.
Strummy on rye with a sour pickle.
A personal puss on a wooden nickel.
Look at me, I'm the king of New York. Suddenly, I'm respectable, staring right at your lousy rich stature.
Knock in the door, the black guy who knocks. I'm coming, my door will go, he locks.
And there I be, and I pray.
It's my city, I'm the king.
Music of Alan Menken, Jack Feldman lyrics in a book by Harvey Fierstein. It's Newsies the Musical at the Orpheum Theater, featuring, among others, Julian de Guzman, who is just my guest here. My regular contributor is now here, Peter Robinson, who caught Newsies recently, and he's also here with a movie review. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I was thinking, just listening to that music, that you can take Newsies out of New York, but you can't take New York out of Newsies. It's definitely got that high-energy, high-octane kind of dance show number. And I think the other thing, and you'll notice this as the curtain rises on the opening set, that the use of scaffolding is really very well done. You get that feel of 19th century Manhattan tenements. And of course, as we've just heard, you know, the story in a sense is topical. The 1899 newsboys strike really meant you weren't going to get the news the way you understood it in newspaper form. Sometimes I think a little better than what Comcast does on cable television, but there we go. So this is a show which really divides mainly into what I call dance, dance, dance. It's highly acrobatic, very well choreographed, and certainly high testosterone, high energy. Even sitting where I was jumping around in my seat, feeling that I needed a session at the gym, because definitely we've got young men, great bodies, and almost athletes.
I think
the dance probably takes over from the music. But there are also a couple of other topical references, such as the female reporter who wants to cover the strike, but it's an issue in those days because you've now got the issue of women in the newsroom. And again, we're going to focus back on the late 19th century. I liked Dan DeLuca. He has a strong, virile voice which carries the day, particularly in numbers like Seize the Day. And he plays the role of Jack, which is at the center of the story. Remember, the Orpheum is a big theater. If you're booking tickets, you want to get as close to the front as you can, because I found in certain places the acoustics didn't quite make it. But if you're looking for a truly flavored New York show, high action, high energy, and I think in many ways probably the most acrobatic type of musical I've seen for a long time, check out Newsies, which is currently running at the Orpheum Theatre here in San Francisco. Now, for something, as they say, completely different, another generation, another era in time, another moment, I think, in history, it is the opening next week of the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. Briefly, if you didn't see the first one, let me fill you in on the backstory. A group of old British retirees have been thumbing through what we call holiday or vacation brochures, and they are all set to go to India, to a hotel which in the brochure looks absolutely magnificent, but when they arrive, they're in for, well, a surprise. Let's not say a shock, but let's say a surprise. And this, of course, has a truly magnificent cast, Judi Dench, Bill Nighy, and Maggie Smith. In fact, I'm calling it the second British invasion. We've had Downton Abbey. Now we've had the Oscars with Imitation Game, The Theory of Everything. But now we're going to invade India for the second time round as this crew of retirees end up at this somewhat dilapidated hotel. And the hotel manager, Sonny, played by Dev Patel, has all the charm and wit that is needed. In fact, the best line I remember from the first one, as everything is not going well, he says, "Everything will be all right in the end, and if it's not all right, it's not the end." So there we have it. That's how life goes at the exotic Marigold Hotel. But the second one has an American visitor, and Richard Gere, looking a little crumpled, a little dishevelled, arrives. And we're not sure whether he's a hotel inspector or whether he's another bunch of tourists. Anyhow, this very well-acted play, I think, is more about getting older, how the older generation views things, and in a strange way, less about the landscape and the culture of India. We have a couple of local scenes. The now traditional India wedding is probably showcased in a way. But essentially, we're looking at a period piece where history has moved forward from the 20th century to the 21st century. And with this cast of professionals, we have got some excellent acting. This is a tourist movie. It's the view of how we perceived India, how India is today, and how the sun, let us get it right now, has finally set on the British Empire. I think you'll enjoy the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, and if you don't, remember, everything will be all right in the end, and if it's not all right, it's not the end.
Thanks, Peter. Here's some music from that movie. Hope you enjoy it. It's the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. Open air for this week. Do join me next week here, same time, same location. And if you missed any of today's show or want to hear some of the past shows, a reminder that they are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for greasing the wheels of Open Air week by week and setting up some guests. If you'd like to appear on the show or have a suggestion for a community ensemble that is performing at would like to appear on Open Air, send me an email, david@kalw.org.